Hi, my name's Nick Smith, founder and creator of Part-Time Pilot. Now, after 3 years, five flight instructors, and over $22,000 out of my bank account, I was finally able to achieve my dream and become a private pilot. Now, I have a bachelor's and master's in aerospace engineering and over 10 years experience as a flight test engineer. So if it was that difficult for someone like me, no wonder 8 out of 10 student pilots never end up becoming a pilot. So this is why I created Part-Time Pilot, and this is why I'm creating this podcast. This podcast will be your audio ground school and just another way Part-Time Pilot is making flight training easier and more consumable for you. So with over 300 students and counting that have used our content to pass the FAA private pilot exams, I hope that you can use this podcast to become the next student to do so. So thank you, and I hope you enjoy listening to the Part-Time Pilot Audio Ground School Podcast. Are you kidding me? I just gave you thousands of dollars for my flight training and now you're telling me I have to buy all this other stuff? That's how I remember feeling when I was in flight training. I had two different flight schools because I moved during my flight training, and both of them said that I had to buy these study books and these plotters and all the things from their own flight school that they had, of course, marked up in price. Little did I know that I really didn't have to do this and that I could have even went to Amazon or a older student and found the, you know, a year old version of these items for much cheaper. And so when you start off flight training, it can get overwhelming because so many people out there know you're willing to spend money for your dream and they can really take advantage of that. So that's why I created a list of our recommended products list, and it breaks it down into the categories that you only the things you need for ground school, only the things you absolutely need for flight school. And then I also have categories for things that you don't necessarily need, but might help you a lot. They make your life easier as a pilot. And then also one more category for things that you definitely don't need, but can be really fun and maybe add some fun to your flying. And we also have a section on exclusive discounts only for part-time pilot listeners. So I've been trying to work with companies that I really like their products. I've tested their products myself over the years and I use them myself. So they're very, very good. So I've tried to work with them to try and get some discounts for our students. That list is growing. I think we have 3 or 4 coupon code discounts in there. So go check that out. You can go to our website, parttimepilot.com, click on students and recommended products, or check out the link in our show notes. Hello, hello, hello. Welcome into the Audio Ground School Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Smith, founder and creator of Part-Time Pilot. So we've been going through starting to do some check ride prep stuff with you guys. Let's see here what we've done so far. We have episode 87 was a couple weeks ago. We started talking about helpful tools and preparation. Then episode 88, 2 weeks ago, we talked about what to expect on your check ride. That one is a really, really powerful episode. So if you missed it, go ahead and check it out. And then now we're getting into what you're going to actually be going through during your check ride. So we laid out what to expect, exactly what to expect. And now the first part is you're going to have to prove your qualifications, right? So you get there, you see the DPE, and they're going to ask you to prove that you're legal to have this flight and be the PIC. So you have to have, you know, your endorsements, your hours, your certificates, your documentation, all that stuff. So we went over that and we did some possible oral exam questions that you're going to get, because while you do this, the examiner is going to throw in some situational based specific questions, oral exam questions throughout the process. And then today we're going to continue that. And this time you have to prove that the aircraft is airworthy. So we're going to talk about all about how you do that and some possible examiner questions that you could get during this process. Now, before we get into that, we have a lot going on at Part-Time Pilot. It's awesome. At the same time, a little stressful, just how much is going on and bobbling it all in two hands, right? So we got a few updates. The first thing I wanted to talk about is our scholarship coming up. So that is our spring scholarship where, you know, we do 4 scholarships a year. And this one is a little bit different than the other ones.
I donate $1,000 and then we try and fundraise. I haven't really fundraised before with you guys, like, you know, small donations, stuff like that. But what I've been working on is trying to get donations from sponsorship corporations. So some other companies in the space, companies that I enjoy, you know, using their products in aviation. You know, we've gotten some great ones, you know, Plain English, their AR sim, great one. Core Aviation, my favorite headsets, Core headsets. Fly Like a Local is a really cool app. And then we're working on a couple others. And so that scholarship application is going to open up in May. And then at the end of May, we're going to do, I'm going to pick the finalists, but this time you guys are going to pick the winners. So I'll pick the finalists, and then the finalists will create like a 1-minute video submission, and then we'll play all those for you guys, and you guys will vote on the winner or winners, depending on how many we want to choose. So that's coming up, so stay tuned for that. That's going to be probably after the first week of May, I'll open up the application. So stay tuned to our Instagram, our email subscription. You can go to parttimepilot.com and go to the contact page to stay informed and be an email subscriber, or you can go to our Instagram at part-time-pilot. Part-time pilot with periods in between each word. All right. The next thing I want to talk about is the price of our online ground school is going up. I announced this last week. So May 1st, but I'm giving everyone a chance. If you're thinking about it now, I'm going to give you a chance to get it at the current lower price. So the current price is $199.99, and it's going to go up to $249.99. It's lifetime access. And if you want to know why, you can check out our Instagram. I've done some posts about why we're doing that really quick here. I've never been more confident in our program, and I've never been more confident in raising our price, that I just feel like this course is so valuable, and I see the effect and the time and the money, because it's all in the name, Part-Time Pilot. Everything has been designed to save student pilots time and money so that the modern day student pilot has a busy work schedule, can still achieve their dream of becoming a pilot. And I can see that every single day. Every single day, someone writes in to us saying how thankful they are that they found us. And when our price is lower than our competitors, it kind of devalues us. People don't take us as much seriously. If you go on like Facebook or something and someone says, hey, what ground school, online ground school should I get? You're going to see Kings, maybe some Gold Seal, you know, maybe like Sporties, right? People still don't really know about Part-Time Pilot. And I think one of it is because our price has been lower, and so people, they don't take us seriously. There's a great book called Predictably Irrational, and it talks about the psychology of consumerism, and we're all guilty of this. I'm no better of it, but it was a really enlightening book, and it talks about how people will make decisions simply based off price. So if you saw a ground school that was $200, and you saw a ground school that was $300, and nothing else, and you were to just, let's say money wasn't an option for you, you were just to pick the one that you thought was going to be the best for you and had the best value, you would probably pick the one, the $300, because you thought, well, it must be better. There must be something wrong or something missing from the $200 one. That's why it's cheaper. And so, and going through this process, I've learned a lot about myself and how when you're the face of the company and you have your own training, how setting your price is really putting a value on yourself in some way. And so it's been a big journey for me as well. And now when you compare the features, our ground school against all the competition, it's not even a competition. It really isn't. We blow them out of the water. We have everything designed to make your life easier, learn the ground content better, quicker, faster, least expensive. So now putting our price relative to other ground schools, so right in that example where instead of a $200 course and a $300 course that you're choosing from, now you have a $250 course and a $250 course, there's nothing you can use. You need more information to decide which one is better value. It causes people when we're around the same price to then look further into the features. And once they do that, I am so confident that they are going to see the value that we have far outweighs any other competition. So that's why we're raising prices. We also, and this leads into my next update, we also have higher costs because we're adding a bunch more features. One of those is we just released a mobile app. I'm kind of doing a quiet kind of release of that. Not sure why. I think probably just because we have so much going on. But we just released a mobile app on both Android and Apple. It's really, really cool. Shout out to the app developer, Bella, did a fantastic job. I'm really, really excited. We're already, you know, looking at making more improvements to it. But it's a great app, and it's completely free. So there's free features, and then there's features that if you log in with your online ground school email and password, you'll get more features. So the free features are a unlimited practice test generator where you can choose how many questions you want and then what categories of questions you want to answer. You can do that as many times as you want. That's completely free. And then the E6B. It's not an E6B that you can, you know, use on the FAA written test. You have to use your paper one or one of the supported electronic ones, but can allow you to do calculations straight from your phone, straight from our app. And like when you're doing cross-country planning stuff, you can check, you know, if you're doing the paper wheel E6B, you can check with our app to make sure that you're getting the right answers. So another powerful tool, completely free. And then if you're an online ground school member, you'll get access to all the ground school lessons, videos, quizzes that are in the lessons. So you'll be able to go through ground school content on your app right there. And then also we have downloads available. Some of our bonus downloads are available so you can download them straight to your phone, tablet, whatever. And again, Android or Apple, doesn't matter the device, just go to the whatever device you have is App Store and search Part-Time Pilot. And then do us a favor and leave us a review. It'd be really, really awesome if you did that. And so that's another thing, right? It costs money to develop and maintain an app. So another reason that we're raising our price a little bit. But as I mentioned earlier, we're still the best deal out there. So a couple updates there. One last update is our IFR online ground school. We released the beta a couple months ago, and we've been getting feedback and incorporating that feedback, creating some more videos. And we are just about, by the time this podcast release, we'll probably be releasing the IFR in just a couple days. So we are really, really close to releasing our IFR ground school for good. So that is really, really exciting. And that's all. So we'll have Private Pilot, IFR, an app, and we are just rolling. We already got more projects underway. It's super exciting. A lot going on in Part-Time Pilot. So come join us and be a part of our great community. So, all right, that's the updates. Now, without further ado, let's go help you out with some check ride prep stuff. All right, so as I mentioned in the What to Expect episode a couple weeks ago, you're going to get there to your check ride. You're going to meet the DPE. You're probably going to pay them. And then you're going to get straight into proving that you and the aircraft are ready for the flight. So you'll start, and this is what we covered last week, proving your documentation, going over your hours, your required hours, your IACRA, all that stuff. And then throughout that, they're going to ask you oral exam-based questions, again, which we kind of covered, did some examples of in the last episode. Then once you've proven that you're ready for this flight and you're legal to fly on this check ride, you're going to get into proving that the aircraft is airworthy. And the goal here is for you to show the examiner that you know what it takes for an aircraft to be airworthy, you know where that documentation is, everything involved, that you can check on that and make sure that your aircraft is safe and airworthy to fly. So that's what you're going to do. You're going to prove to them that the aircraft you're flying that day is airworthy. And again, during that process, they're going to ask you oral exam type questions, which we'll go over a couple examples of today. The last sort of part of that, other than the pre-flight check, of course, is showing the weight and balance for the aircraft, showing that it's within limits, you're safe to fly, all that stuff with the weights that you're going to carry in that day. Now, we're not going to go over how to do the weight and balance because we already have a podcast episode on that from the ground school, which you can go back and listen to. But I might just tell you a couple of oral exam questions that you might get from the examiner when you do that. So let's get to it. All right, proving that your aircraft is airworthy for the check ride. As I mentioned, the next thing the examiner is going to want to see is that if the aircraft is airworthy or not. To prove that an aircraft is airworthy, you'll need to show the examiner the following. Required documentation is current and present. Required inspections are current and completed. All airworthiness directives have been met. There are no open squawks for the aircraft. And all required equipment is present and operational. This is one of the questions that students get wrong the most. When I say what goes in, when I do a mock check rides, I say what goes into making an aircraft airworthy? What's everything that makes an aircraft airworthy? Usually they just think of the required documentation, right? Aero. There's required documentation, but then one of those documents is the airworthiness certificate. And in that document is only valid if you do all these other things. So it branches out to all these other requirements that include inspections, airworthiness directives, squawks, required equipment, all that stuff. So there is more than just the required documentation. And so again, that's required documentation, required inspections, airworthiness directives, squawks, and required equipment. And this information can be found in a combination of the POH or AFM for your aircraft, aircraft maintenance logs, and logbooks. 2 to 3 days prior to your check ride, you should schedule a meeting with the owner, operator, mechanic of the aircraft that have access to these logbooks. Some aircraft have one maintenance log while others have separate logbooks for airframe and power plant, which is another name for the engine. But make sure you have all the maintenance logs plus the aircraft hour log and squawk log. During your meeting with the owner, operator, mechanic, make sure each of the below requirements is met and signed off in the logbooks. Then mark the location with a sticky note so that it's really easy during your check ride to just flip to that specific page. So for example, you're going to look for the annual inspection to make sure the annual inspection was done. That might be 5 pages deep in the aircraft maintenance logbook. So you want to put a sticky note on there so you can just easily flip to it. That way you're not fumbling around. And again, and this is a central theme, especially at the beginning of a check ride, is to show that you're prepared, you're organized right at the bat with your examiner. It's going to make a good first impression and make things a lot easier for yourself. A lot of the inspections are recurring items, so you'll want to mark the most recent that should prove it has been inspected within the required amount of time, right? So like the 100 hour or the annual done every year, 100 hours done every 100 hours. So there's going to be multiple entries in the logbook, and you just want the most recent to prove that, okay, the annual was done 6 months ago, so that's within a year, so we're good there. Boom. So first up, let's talk about required documentation. Along with your personal documents, you must also have documents supporting the aircraft that you are flying. Just like in a car, you need your driver's license, but you also need your car insurance and registration. No person may operate a civil aircraft unless it is airworthy. That means it has within it the following: an airworthiness certificate, registration, radio operator's license if an international flight, probably not you on your check ride, operating limitations, and weight and balance. So remember, this is ARROW, the mnemonic ARROW, A-R-R-O-W, which tells us the required documentation. Let's go into detail on a little bit of each of these, just so we can get some good information on how often they're required, what they're required for, all that. So the airworthiness certificate, like I said earlier, is good for the life of the aircraft as long as the required maintenance and inspections is performed per all airworthiness directives and required inspections. And then we'll get into what those are here in a bit. The airworthiness certificate is required to be in the aircraft when it is flying so that you can find it in the aircraft or aircraft log. You'll want to have this with you and ready to show the examiner. The next is a registration certificate. This is good for 7 years. It used to be 3. It recently just changed from 3 to 7. It's effective January 23rd, 2023. So it's effective now. 7 years, those things are good. Or if the aircraft changes ownership. If an airplane is operating with a dealership certification of registration, the aircraft must be immediately registered by any new owner who purchases the airplane. This will also be found in the aircraft or aircraft log, and you will want to have this with you and make sure that it is current. Next is the radio operator's license. This is, again, for international flights only, so there's not much to talk about here. Next is the O of ARROW, and that's operating limitations. These can be found in a variety of places. So in the current FAA-approved flight manual, or POH, approved manual material, markings, and placards, or any combination thereof. So one example that your examiner might ask you is to show you some limitations that are in the cockpit. So you might have some placards listed, placarded right on your dashboard, but there's also a bunch on the airspeed indicator. That's a great example, right? It's got, you know, the never exceed speed, the operating limits and ranges of speed, the stall speeds, the zero flap speed. So all that stuff, those are all considered operating limitations that are marked on the aircraft themselves. Then you'll also have some that are listed in the POH or AFM. Finally, the W is the weight and balance of the aircraft. Again, this can be the weight and balance sheet and information will be found in the flight manual, and then you'll calculate this ahead of time with the updated weights. Many students, again, use the acronym ARROW to remember, so I think you guys all know that, but again, ARROW is airworthiness, registration, radio operators, operating limitations, and weight and balance. One possible examiner question: does the airworthiness certificate expire? And so you would say, no, as long as the aircraft is kept airworthy by meeting all required inspections and airworthiness directives. And they might say, does the aircraft registration expire? And you can say, yes, it expires after 7 years, or if the aircraft changes ownership. Okay, so you've showed the examiner the airworthiness certificate, the registration, and then the weight and balance. And again, we'll get to that in a second. You showed those required equipment. What else did I? Registration and the operating limitations, right? So you've showed that. So now we're going to go into, they might say, well, how do you know that airworthiness certificate is good? We're like, okay, well, we have to meet these required inspections. And if you remember, that is aviates, the mnemonic aviates. So again, in order for the aircraft to stay airworthy, legal to fly per FAA, certain inspections must be performed in their defined time frame. These inspections will be recorded and logged in the aircraft maintenance logs. Most aircraft have both a power plant and airframe log. Therefore, you will need these logbooks on the day of your check ride. Ask your flight school to get them from the mechanics the day of your check ride. And then again, I have the tip, get the aircraft maintenance logs the day before or a couple days before and mark each of the below required inspections, you know, the most recent time they were recorded with a sticky note, and make sure then that they all meet the requirements. I remember on my check ride, I found that one was actually out of the allotted time frame, and so they had to get that done before my check ride. So there's a lot of problems I had around my flight school that were annoying like that, and that was one of them. So make sure, because if that happens on your day of your check ride, you might fail. The examiner might fail you for that. They likely will fail you for that. So make sure, do this a couple days ahead of time. All right, so what are the required inspections? So we have, again, this is the mnemonic aviate. So that stands for annual, VOR, 100-hour, altimeter, transponder, ELT, and static impedo. Now, as a private pilot for VFR, not all of these are required for VFR. So let's get into a little bit when these are required and if they're required for VFR and IFR. So the annual is required every 12 months. And it's required for both VFR and IFR flight. If the aircraft has both an airframe and power plant logbook, you will need to check for the annual inspection logged in each of them within the last 12 calendar months to show the examiner. So the airframe and the power plant both have to be examined and marked off as part of the annual inspection. Then the next is VOR. This is required every 30 days for IFR flights only. If you are flying a VOR-equipped aircraft, it is still a good idea to know where this inspection is logged to show the examiner, even though it is not required for VFR flight. The examiner may not ask to see it, but you will want to be prepared to show them and say, even though this is only required for IFR flight, it is still current in that it has been inspected in the last 30 days. This is good to know for us since we want to use our VORs anyways, and it gives us the insurance that it has been inspected recently. All right, next is the 100 hour. So every 100 hours of aircraft operation per the tachometer, only required for aircraft used for hire, and that's both IFR and VFR. For the situation where you are a student renting an aircraft from a flight school and flying in the aircraft with an instructor, the aircraft is considered for hire because flight instructor is getting paid. Now, this is a very confusing topic. This is where I've landed on the subject. I've even asked like legal lawyers how to, you know, dissect this particular FAR, and this is how I understood it. It's kind of a tough one, but I think what a lot of flight schools do is they just do the 100 hour inspection anyways, because some of the hours could be considered 100 hours, some could not, and it just makes it, instead of tracking some and not tracking the other, it just makes it easier to do every 100 hours. So I think that's the most common way to do it. But once you get into like owning your own aircraft, stuff like that, or renting an aircraft and then renting, paying a flight instructor for someone else or something, it gets a little convoluted and complicated. But as far as I understand it, when you rent an aircraft and fly it solo, then it wouldn't be considered for hire because you don't have that paid flight instructor by the flight school that is with you. So this means that for most aircraft owned and rented by a flight school, most of the hours are considered for hire, and therefore the flight school will get the aircraft inspected every 100 hours for that required inspection. If the aircraft has both an airframe and power plant logbook, you will need to check for the 100-hour inspection logged in each of them within the last 100 hours of the aircraft. So in that log, it'll say the tack hours of when they did the inspection. So let's say it's like 1432. So you say, okay, the last 100-hour was done at 1432. then you would want to go look at the current tack hours on the aircraft and make sure that that was not more than 100 from 1432, right? Note here, an aircraft is allowed to fly past 100 hours since its last inspection only for 10 hours, and any time over 100 hours must be spent flying the aircraft to a destination where it will be inspected. This is kind of a caveat to the rule of every 100 hours. For example, you can fly your aircraft over 100 hours if at 99.9 hours you take off and fly to an airport where the inspection will occur for up to 10 hours over 100 hours or 110 hours. So you can fly 10 hours away, right? So that's that you're at 109.9 hours as long as you're flying to somewhere where it's going to get the inspection done. And if this happens, the excess time above 100 hours must be used in computing the next 100 hours. What this means is, if you fly your aircraft at 99.9 hours for 5 hours to a place where it's inspected, then it would be getting inspected at 104.9 hours, right? But the next time it would need to be inspected not at 204.9 hours, it would still be at 200 hours. It's still required every 100 hours. So at 100 hours, 200 hours, 300 hours, if you overfly it using this exception, that doesn't reset. That's included. You're using some of that next 100 hours. Hopefully that makes sense. It's kind of hard to explain, but I think you guys get that if you've gone through ground school. All right, next is altimeter. Required every 24 calendar months, and that's for IFR only. Again, mark with a sticky note and show your examiner and just say, I know this is for IFR only, but it makes me feel good that it's been inspected because I use the altimeter a lot. All right, next up is transponder. Required every 24 calendar months. It's not required for particular VFR or IFR, but flight within, it depends on where you're flying, right? So you might get questions about this. They might say, hey, on our flight today, do we need a transponder? And do we need the transponder to have been inspected in the last 24 calendar months? And so those are things like if it's in flight within a mode C veil, flight inside class A, B, or C airspace, flight above class B or C airspace, flight above 10,000 feet MCEL. So if your flight is going through any of those situations, then you're going to need a transponder. And again, mark your sticky note and let them know that, hey, our transponder has been inspected the last 24 calendar months, even if your flight does not go through these things. You know, another tip is to just kind of be ahead of the questions that you can expect to get, right? And provide more information so that they don't have to ask more questions. So for example, instead of saying, here's the transponder inspections, it's been done 13 months ago. Instead of just saying that, you could say it was done 13 months ago, which required every 24 months, so we're good for another 11 months there. It's only required if we fly in a mode C veil, class A, B, C airspace, above class B or C, or a flight above 10,000 feet. Our flight has none of that, but it's still nice to know that it's been inspected because I will use it to get flight following. Something like that, right? Give a detailed answer showing that you know all the rules and regulations around that particular topic so that they don't have to ask more questions, right? All right, next up is the ELT or emergency locator transmitter. A functional check is required every 12 calendar months, and the battery must be replaced at half its used life or after an hour of cumulative operation. The half-life will almost always be printed on the battery itself. That could be a question that you might get. You know, the examiner might be like, how do you know what the half-life is? Where can you find that information? So you can look on the battery itself or in maybe the documentation for the aircraft. All right, ELT is required for both VFR and IFR flight. Again, mark this with a sticky note when it was last inspected or when it had its last functional check, right? Okay, the static impedo is the last one. That's required every 24 calendar months, but only for IFR. Again, same thing. We use the static impedo in a lot of our instruments, so it's good to know that it's been inspected and working well, even though it's required, this check is only required for IFR. All right, again, that mnemonic is AVATES, AV1ATES, annual VOR, 100 hour, altimeter, transponder, ELT, static, and pedo. A couple questions you might get from your examiner are, can I fly my aircraft past the 100 hour mark since its last 100 hour inspection? So this is, they're trying to ask you about that exception to the rule, right? So you might say, if your aircraft is not for hire, you do not require 100 hour. If your aircraft is for hire, like when a student flies a rented aircraft with a paid instructor, You do require a 100-hour inspection. You're only allowed to fly it over 100 hours by up to 10 hours over, if and only if you are flying to a destination where you're getting that 100-hour inspection. So they might then say, in a follow-up to that question on the 100-hour inspection, they might give an example of like, okay, say I flew 5 hours over my 100-hour. Is my next inspection due in 95 hours? Right? And so you would say, no, it's due every 100 hours. You don't get an extra 5 hours because you went over the previous time. Okay? So kind of understand where they're trying to go with their questions. The next one, if I'm flying Class E or uncontrolled airspace, do I need my transponder to be inspected every 24 months? So you might say to that, you will only need a transponder in Class E or G airspace if you fly through remote sea veil above Class Bravo or Charlie airspace or above 10,000 feet MSL. You might ask specifically, you know, for our flight, do we need a transponder? So you would want to kind of prep ahead of time to know that based off your cross-country scenario that they give you. And then finally, you might get, as I mentioned before, where can I find the half-life of an ELT battery to ensure it's up to date on its inspection? You could say it's printed on the battery itself or in the aircraft maintenance logs. And it might be a good idea when you meet the mechanic, right, to ask if they can show you where this is. That way you can know for sure and certain where that is for your aircraft. All right, let's continue on. Now let's talk about airworthiness directives. Right after you show the examiner that the required inspections have been completed, you should show them that the aircraft meets any and all applicable airworthiness directives. An airworthiness directive, or AD, is a notice by the FAA that defines an unsafe condition that commonly occurs in an aircraft type and prescribes the appropriate corrective action. ADs for your aircraft must be met in order for your aircraft to be considered airworthy. Proof of compliance should be documented, again, in the aircraft maintenance records and logbooks. Before every flight, USPIC must ensure that the aircraft is airworthy and under compliance of all ADs. ADs can be normal or emergency issuance. ADs can also be recurring or one time. A recurring AD must be met on a recurring basis according to the AD. For an example, an AD may specify that a certain brand of tubing can be replaced every 100 hours of use. A one-time AD is just like it sounds. For example, an AD may specify to replace all models of a certain altimeter. Example, if an AD is issued for all PA-28-161 aircraft that use a specific brand, let's call it XYZ, of all alternator belts, and says that they must be replaced every 6 months in order to be compliant with the AD, in this example, if your aircraft uses alternator brand XYZ, then you must replace it every 6 months, and you must record this replacement in your aircraft maintenance logbooks and put the AD number. Alternatively, you could use a different brand, let's call it ABC, that is not part of the AD, and then you wouldn't have to worry about replacing it every 6 months, right? So every AD is different, right? So this AD says if you're using brand XYZ, you got to replace it every 6 months. Or you can use brand ABC, and you just would make sure that there's no ADs for that brand of alternator belt. Okay, if you have not replaced alternate brand XYZ in the last 6 months in this example, and then your aircraft would not be legally allowed to fly. It wouldn't be airworthy. There may also be a case where the AD explicitly says that you are allowed to fly the aircraft even if your aircraft is not in compliance with the AD. For example, an AD might state that you are required to replace a specific part of your aircraft, but that you may fly the aircraft until a specific date or until a specific amount of hours has been flown. They may allow you to fly the aircraft because they want you to be able to get the aircraft to the point where the repairs are to be made, among other reasons. So again, it all depends on the AD. Make sure you read all the wording of the AD and make sure that your aircraft is in compliance with the specific wording of the AD. To summarize, you cannot fly an aircraft unless it is in compliance with the AD or if the AD gives you a particular exception for flight. So for your check ride, check to see if your aircraft has any ADs. If it does, read the AD and understand its requirements so that you can show the required replacement, inspection, etc. that is required by the AD to the examiner. All right, now let's kind of recap what we've done. We showed them the required documentation, right, which included, among other things, airworthiness certificate. And then for that airworthiness certificate to be valid, we had to have met all our required inspections and be up to date and current on all our ADs. The next thing that is included in that airworthiness certificate is that we have all the required equipment and that all that required equipment is operational. So let's talk about the required equipment that you need for your flight. So at this point in your check ride, you need to show the examiner that all the aircraft's required equipment is present and operable. This is what your pre-flight check and checklist is for, but we're going to cover it here because in order for your aircraft to be airworthy, you need to have the required equipment for your type of flight, whether that's day, night, VFR, IFR. While flying in VFR during the day, the following equipment is required: airspeed indicator, compass, altimeter, fuel gauge, oil temperature, oil pressure, temperature gauge for liquid-cooled engine, manifold pressure gauge for each altitude engine, landing gear position indicator for retractable landing gear, tachometer, seatbelts and harnesses, ELT, and anti-collision lights. So this is A, tomato flames, and that's the mnemonic for 91205, which you're familiar with. Now, I mentioned before, right, you're going to do this in your pre-flight check. So before your pre-flight check, you know, maybe, you know, you're showing the examiner that your aircraft is airworthy. You might just mention, you know, like, here's the required equipment for the aircraft. It's A, tomato flames, plus, and we'll get to this in a sec, but plus anything listed in the POH specific for your aircraft. And then you could say, we're going to check these to be operational during our pre-flight check. But you might want to say it here. If your examiner asks, you can show them what exactly is required for your aircraft. So as I mentioned, right, most general aviation trainer aircraft don't have tractable landing gear. They don't have altitude engines or liquid-cooled engines. Most of them are air-cooled. Plus, tomato flames might not be for your aircraft, right? So if you don't have landing gear, retractable landing gear, then that's not required. If you don't have a liquid-cooled engine, right, then the manifold, or sorry, then the temperature gauge is not required. So you want to tailor this for your specific aircraft is what I'm trying to say. And on top of that is there might be a kinds of operation list or other required equipment specified in the approved flight manual or POH of your aircraft. So another question for your, you know, the owner, operator, mechanic is, are there any additional required equipment for this specific aircraft or the specific kind of operation we're going to use it in? So you want to know the exact list for your aircraft, and that's a combination of 91205 and the POH AFM for your aircraft. All right, so that is required equipment during the day. Your examiner might ask you, you know, what if our flight goes into the night? What changes, right? And one of the things that changes is there's more equipment required. And that we remember that by flaps, right? So that's fuses, landing light, anti-collision light, position light, and a source of electricity. So the source of electricity is going to be the alternator with a backup as the battery. Position lights, anti-collision lights, you're well aware of. Landing light, it's only if aircraft is for hire. That might be a question that you could ask. The AIM specifically encourages pilots to turn on their landing light when operating below 10,000 feet, day or night, especially when operating in reduced visibility. And then for the fuses, you need a replacement set or three of each. And then newer aircraft use circuit breakers, so that's kind of like fuses or circuit breakers, that requirement for the F part of flaps. All right. Additionally, a pilot should consider bringing more personal equipment during a night flight. So again, I mentioned that the examiner might say, what consideration, they might phrase it like, what considerations would you have if our flight was planned at night or we might fly into the night? And so you might say, well, we have the required equipment that is required for night. But also, you might want to add to that. So you might say, you might talk about the dangers of illusions during night, how the eyeballs detect light differently at night, hazards during the night, and more equipment, as I mentioned, that you can bring during the night to mitigate some of this risk. And some of that equipment could be like iPad GPS checklists, flashlight with white, red, and blue, backup batteries or backup charger, right? Because the big thing at night is electricity, an overnight bag, maybe a jacket, some food, something like that. So these are some additional things that you can show that you plan ahead when you're faced with something different like night flight. And then I talk about another big one there is the night blindness. So they might go into that a little bit further. And they might say, do we have to use our strobes during taxi at night? You know, they're kind of leading into, you know, if there's other aircraft around taxiing at night, the strobes can cause night blindness, and they might want you to explain what night blindness is, you know, for like 30 minutes. If you have a bright white light, causes kind of temporary blindness, makes things hard to see, especially like other aircraft when you're up at flight. That's why you want to avoid these bright white lights. That's why you want to use a red flashlight. Things like that might be asked by examiner, and that's what they're looking for. All right. So next I want to talk about inoperable equipment. So when you get to this point where you're talking about the required equipment, they might ask some things about inoperable equipment. The responsibility for ensuring that an aircraft is maintained in an airworthy condition is primarily that of the owner operator. However, a private pilot must know whether or not the aircraft is airworthy and what actions must be taken to keep or make it airworthy. In the event that any piece of equipment in the aircraft becomes inoperable, broken, not working, then the pilot must verify the following before flying the aircraft. So you want to check to see if the aircraft has an MEL, a minimum equipment list. If it does, then this is the controlling document that must be followed. The MEL is a list and quantity of installed instruments and equipment, the quantity required for flight, and any added limitation caused by out-of-surface items. To use an MEL, a pilot must verify that the owner-operator has received written approval from the FAA to do so. If the aircraft does not have an MEL, which most trainer aircraft do not, MELs are usually used for like large jets who have many redundant systems and really long amounts of equipment. So if you don't have an MEL, which is highly likely, then the type certificate data sheet per 91213D2I manufacturer's kinds of operations equipment list per 91213D2II and 14 CFR 91205 or any other Part 91 regulation for the specific kind of flight operation being conducted, again per 91213D2III, and airworthiness directives per 91213D2IV must be consulted to determine if the equipment is required. Okay, so what does this mean? Well, this is what I was talking about earlier, right? We have 91205, which is A tomato flames. So that's the general set of requirements for the required equipment. But also there might be additional required equipment, that's what this is saying, in the type certificate data sheet, the kinds of operation list, or the airworthiness directives. So when you don't have an MEL for your aircraft, you use a combination of 91205A tomato flames and these other things, the kinds of operation list in your POH, type certificate data sheet, airworthiness directives, all that to see if there's any other required equipment for your aircraft. If not required by any of the above, or what we mentioned, then the item may be either deactivated and placarded, inoperative, or removed. Only then is the aircraft legal to fly. So let's say it's not required by any of them, and it's inoperable, then you may deactivate it and placard it as inoperative, or remove it. So that leads to the question, who can perform necessary maintenance for you to fly? Well, the FAR says no person may take off an aircraft with inoperable instruments or equipment installed unless the inoperative instruments and equipment are, one, removed from the aircraft, the cockpit control placarded, and the maintenance recorded in accordance with Part 43.9 of this chapter, or two, deactivated and placarded inoperative. If deactivation of the inoperative instrument or equipment involves maintenance, it must be accomplished and recorded in accordance with Part 43 of this chapter. So what is Part 43? Well, Part 43 says that a private pilot may perform preventative maintenance. Now, there are still debates among even law professionals and pilots as to how these FARs should be interpreted, but for a student and private pilot, it's best to be conservative and assume that a private pilot may only perform preventative maintenance and that repairing, replacing, removing, or deactivating equipment does not constitute as preventative. Some forums and boards online may tell you to just mark it as an operative if it's not required for your flight, but this is wrong. The FAR clearly states and says you must also deactivate it, and the act of deactivating equipment does not sound preventative to me. The reason the FAA wants you to deactivate equipment is because you never know if the problem is larger than just a single electrical circuit you are concerned about. your inoperative equipment may be causing high voltages and wires that start a fire if not deactivated properly. So to summarize that, right? If we have something that is not required, we have a piece of equipment that is not required for our aircraft, right? We check to see if our aircraft has an MEL. It doesn't have an MEL. So then we use A Tomato Flames plus anything listed in our POH or our type certificate data sheet or our ADs. Okay. So we know the list of what's required. And let's say that equipment that's inoperable is not on that list. So it's not required. We can still fly if we either have it deactivated and placarded inoperative, or we have it completely removed. And we have this done by not by ourselves, right? We have a certified mechanic do this. Then we can be legal to fly. And then in that, we talk about not just marking it as an op, as literally you'll see this online, people saying you can do this, but the FAR clearly states you have to also deactivate it. So whatever that means, whether it's unplugging the unit, you know, removing the wires, you have to deactivate it because you never know what, you know, behind the dashboard, what's going on that could lead to a bigger problem. And that's why we want a certified mechanic to do it. That's why, in my eyes, again, this is one of the most confusing FARs out there, but in my eyes, this does not constitute preventative maintenance that a private pilot is allowed to do. So those are some things to think about that you might get questions on from your examiner when you talk about, start talking about the required equipment. They might ask you, you know, what if this piece of equipment is inoperable? And if it's required, then you can't fly, right? Because it's required. If it's not required, then you have some options, right? Have a certified mechanic deactivate and placard it or completely remove it. And then once you answer that, they might get into, well, can you just do the maintenance? And then you might explain, well, private pilots can only do preventative maintenance. To me, this doesn't count as preventative maintenance, and I'll err on the side of being conservative and have a professional mechanic do it. So just some things to think about. Couple other notes here. Important to note that the removal would have to be performed and logged pursuant to FAR Part 43, as would the deactivation if it involves maintenance. If the aircraft is not airworthy with the instrument or equipment inoperative, then either it would need to be repaired where it is, or prior to flying the aircraft to a repair station, you would obtain a special flight permit, commonly known as a ferry permit. So a special flight permit may be issued to any U.S. registered aircraft that may not currently meet applicable airworthiness requirements, but is capable for safe flight. Special flight permits are issued by the FISDO IFO having jurisdiction over the geographical area in which the flight is originated. An applicant for a special flight permit must submit a statement to in a form, FAA Form 8130-6, before passengers can be carried in an aircraft that has been altered in any manner that may appreciably change the flight, its flight characteristics, must be flight tested by a pilot who holds at least a private pilot certificate. So I don't think the examiner is going to ask you that in-depth detail about special flight permits, but it's good to understand what they are, right? So if it's something that's required and you need to fly somewhere, but you can prove that it's still safe for flight, at least to fly it, to ferry it to a place where it can get fixed, then you can get a special flight permit from your local FISDO. So that, just kind of remember that part of it, of those details, and you should be fine on your check ride. All right, last couple things I want to mention here, still talking about, you know, the whole subject of airworthiness, and it's one students forget about all the time, and that's squawks. You'll also need to show the examiner that there are no open squawks for your aircraft. Squawk sheets are kept for aircraft as a way for pilots to communicate inoperable equipment to the aircraft mechanics while also adding accountability for correcting issues. The FAA states that an aircraft must be grounded if any of the required equipment is inoperable. Therefore, a mechanic must review and sign off on all aircraft squawks made by pilots in the aircraft logbook. The mechanic may sign the squawk off and say the equipment is working as expected, or they may sign the squawk off because they have replaced the inoperable equipment. Or finally, they may sign the squawk off because they have disconnected the equipment and marked it as inoperative, and the equipment is not required by the FAA. So basically, if a pilot writes up a squawk, that plane is grounded and not airworthy until that squawk is written off by a mechanic. So another annoying thing about the flight school I went to is they were teaching me all this stuff, right? You know, they taught me this stuff. And so it happened to me where there was, I think it was the landing light wasn't working. And as we know, landing lights are not required for all types of flight. I decided to write it up and they actually kind of got annoyed at me because it grounded the aircraft. And I just think that kind of culture and that atmosphere of me doing the right thing and writing something up, you know, because maybe a pilot at night does need the landing light, right? And they go to use it and it's not working. Like, I would want other pilots to know that, hey, this is not working before they go on a night flight. So I wrote it up and they got annoyed at me for doing that. And I just think the culture of that around the safety of aircraft is just not cool. That, to me, promotes an unsafe culture. And just another thing, another gripe I had about my flight training experience. Last thing I want to mention is aircraft maintenance. We talked about it. The preventative maintenance that may be performed by a private pilot that owns or operates his or her own aircraft is limited to items in 14 CFR Part 43.7 as long as they do not involve complex assembly operations. So I'm not going to go through the whole entire list. It's very, very long, but we do have it here in the check ride prep course. Might behoove you, I always love that word, might behoove you to remember a couple of them for your check ride, right? Just in case I could see an examiner being like, all right, you know, when we're talking about, you know, removing inoperable equipment, they might say, you know, can you as a private pilot do that? You might say, no, we're only allowed to do preventative maintenance. And so who on aircraft that we own or operate. And then they might say, well, what is some examples of preventative maintenance? What does that mean? So you might say it doesn't involve complex assembly operations. For example, you might repair a landing gear tire, or you might change the oil, you might service landing gear wheel bearings. See, what are some good examples that are easy to remember? It's like air in the tires, replacing or repairing the tires is a good one. Replacing safety belts, harnesses, stuff like that. Talk about the oil. Updating a GPS database is a good one to remember. Replacing and servicing batteries. Yeah, so just I would remember just a few of these. Just so you have something in your pocket if they ask for an example of what kind of preventative maintenance is. And once the preventative maintenance is complete, you'll need to log the maintenance appropriately in the appropriate logbook for the aircraft. And the entry has to include a description of the work performed or references to data that are acceptable to the administrator, the date of completion, the signature, certificate number, and kind of certificate held by the person performing the work. This logbook entry and signature returns the aircraft to service. The ultimate responsibility for ensuring the maintenance personnel or yourself, if performing preventative maintenance on your own aircraft, make the appropriate entries in the aircraft maintenance records indicating the aircraft has been approved for return to service lies with the owner operator. If it's your own aircraft and you're a private pilot, you're allowed to do the preventative maintenance. And this lies on you to ensure that you do this and you sign it off. Any pilot with a pilot certificate from Part 61 is allowed to perform preventative maintenance on an aircraft they own or operate. This includes private and commercial pilots, but does not include student or recreational pilots. So again, maybe another question you get. Hopefully they don't ask you too many questions on preventative maintenance because it's kind of a tricky topic there. But again, like I said, good to know the general rules around it and maybe a couple examples. All right, so to summarize, that's the lesson. We've gone through possible examiner questions that you might get while you're proving that the aircraft is airworthy. You're first going to do that by showing the required documentation. Included in that is the airworthiness certificate. And for that to be valid, you have to meet all the inspections, required inspections. You have to meet the ADs. So you have to prove that the inspections are met, the ADs are met, again, in the maintenance logbooks. Then you have to have the required equipment and make sure that all the required equipment for your specific aircraft and the kinds of flight you're going to do. So you want to use, you know, a tomato flames, aka 91205, plus your aircraft POH or any other, you know, type certificate data sheet or AD that might include additional required equipment for your aircraft. That's going to be your complete list if you don't have an MEL. Then when you go out in pre-flight, you're going to check that all your required equipment is working or not. If you find anything that's not working, if it's required or not working, you cannot fly. You're not airworthy because it's required. If it's not required, we have some wiggle room. Like we said, a certified mechanic can remove it or deactivate it and mark it as inoperative. And then we talked about squawks, right? You have to check the squawks, that there's no open squawks and it's been returned to service for any squawk issues. And then we talked about aircraft maintenance around kind of inoperable equipment and that we want to have a certified mechanic do that. We're only allowed, if we own, we're a private pilot and we own our own aircraft, to do preventative maintenance. All right. So hopefully that was helpful. Kind of a long-winded episode here. I tried to add some things that I thought, you know, you might get from the examiner. So hopefully that was helpful. In next week's episode, so that's going to be on April 29th, we're going to continue on with our check ride prep stuff. And we're going to talk more about the oral exam. And then we're going to get into our cross-country scenario. Actually, first, before I do that, let's talk a little bit about the weight and balance. So that's kind of the last thing on proving your aircraft is airworthy, right? Is showing the examiner your weight and balance, that you've done the calculation for the weight and balance. You're within the CG envelope. But maybe there's some questions that you might get. So let me see here some questions I can think of or that we have here in check ride prep around weight and balance. One possible examiner question is you're showing them, you know, the CG envelope, and they might say, if the CG is too far forward, how would that affect flight? So you might say, too far forward center of mass can cause the aircraft to pitch so far down that it makes climbing in the aircraft nearly impossible. It would also put a lot of stress on the control surfaces and decrease performance. In landing, a nose-heavy CG would make it extremely difficult, if not impossible, to flare, and could cause excessive loads on the nose wheel or a nose over-condition on a tailwheel aircraft. They might also ask, what if the CG is too far aft? How would that affect flight? And you might say, too far aft center of mass can cause the aircraft to want to constantly pitch up, making it harder to control and ultimately less stable. Aircraft loaded with an aft CG are unstable at any speed and can make recovering from a stall or spin extremely difficult, if not impossible. A too far aft CG causes a decrease in both static and dynamic longitudinal stability, as well as violent stall characteristics. Be ready for questions around stability and how a too far forward or too far aft CG can affect your flight, right? They might have you do your weight and balance, and they might have you add, maybe they'll change their weight from 150 pounds to 300 pounds so that you have a lot of weight in the front of the aircraft in that passenger seat. So now you're going to have a nose, kind of think about what they're trying to do, right? They're trying to say, okay, they're trying to create a nose heavy situation. And then they might ask, how might this affect us on landing, right? So a nose heavy CG will make it really hard to flare, might cause a nose over, blah, 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 blah. So that's kind of what you want to think about when you're doing your weight and balance. Let's see if there's any other questions I can think of here. After showing them the weight and balance, they might tell you that you are bringing an additional weight with you. So like I said, right, they might change a weight on you or something. And they might ask you to recalculate and say, did the additional weight move the CG? So what you want to do here is you want to compare the CG location with your first calculation with the new one. And if it's different, then it moved. And the change they give you may shift the CG slightly if it's in a location that's far away from the empty weight's arm length, right? So the empty weight CG, if you're adding weight, you know, much further forward than that or much further aft, then it's definitely going to have more of an effect on changing the CG. And they might say something like, if the CG moved, how does this affect flight? It's kind of what we talked about. And then kind of judge that they're going for, you know, too far forward CG, how that affects flight, too far aft CG, how that affects flight, like we talked about. And then they may further add to that scenario, right? So they might say, they might give you added weight that actually puts you over the total. So that's another thing you got to watch out for. You know, are you within the max gross weight for your aircraft? And I could see an examiner, you know, giving you a weight that puts you over that max gross weight. So maybe it's by like 40 pounds or something like that. And so then you say, well actually, you know, we're over the max gross weight. So before you even need to calculate the CG, right, you can just say that. And they might say, okay, well, how can we get under the max gross weight? You know, what are some things we can do? And you could say, well, we could maybe take out some fuel, or we can get rid of the baggage. And they might say, well, you can't take out a baggage. So like, okay, well, I'm going to take out fuel. It's 40 pounds we need to lose, 6 pounds per gallon. So we're going to lose 7 gallons. And then they might say, what risk considerations would you have in this scenario? And then now you think of the next thing, like, what does removing fuel mean? You know, now do you have enough fuel for your planned flight, right? So you're going to have planned a check ride scenario with them. And so you'll have to reference that total fuel that you calculated. And you say, well, I calculated that we're only going to need, you know, 27 gallons for our flight. You know, our aircraft holds 48 gallons of usable fuel. So if we take 7 from that, planned filling up all the way. So if we take 7 gallons from that, then we're at 41 gallons. We're still well over even, you know, getting to our destination and having all the reserve fuel. So we're good to go. We can remove 7 gallons. And then that may lead them to ask, like, well, what are those fuel requirements? And you might want to say, well, you know, during the day, we need 30 extra minutes at cruise flight and 45 minutes if it's at night. Things like that, that I could see an examiner kind of leading towards in their questions while you're doing your weight and balance. All right. So yeah, glad I remembered that. I think those were good for the weight and balance. So now that you've done that, the next kind of step is you're going to go over your cross-country scenario. So before you go out to the aircraft, do your pre-flight check and do all that stuff, the oral exam is still not over with. The next step is kind of the check ride scenario. So they're going to probably be like, all right, well, it looks like the aircraft is airworthy. You've done a good job proving that. It looks like you're airworthy. So now show me what the flight we're going on today and walk me through our flight and our checkpoints. And then they're going to ask you questions throughout that process as well. And that's what we're going to cover in the next episode. And then after that, we're going to talk about, you know, more oral exam type questions and then get into what to expect on the practical part of the exam. And then after that, like mid-May, we'll do a mock check ride episode. All right. So stay tuned for that. Got a lot of good stuff coming up. And don't forget about the scholarship. Stay tuned for that. Don't forget to check out our mobile app on Android or Apple. Just search Part-Time Pilot. Donate to the scholarship coming up or share it. The GoFundMe link is in the show notes. And be sure to get ready for our IFR course coming out. Lots and lots of good stuff coming from us. So thank you guys, and I'll catch you next week. All right. So hopefully that was helpful. Kind of a long-winded episode here. I tried to add some things that I thought, you know, you might get from the examiner. So hopefully that was helpful. In next week's episode, so that's going to be on April 29th, we're going to continue on with our check ride prep stuff. And we're going to talk more about the oral exam, and then we're going to get into our cross-country scenario. So that's kind of the next thing we talked about. Actually, first, before I do that, let's talk a little bit about the weight and balance. So that's kind of the last thing on proving your aircraft is airworthy, right? Is showing the examiner your weight and balance, that you've done the calculation for the weight and balance. You're within the CG envelope. But maybe there's some questions that you might get. So let me see here some questions I can think of or that we have here in check ride prep around weight and balance. So yeah, one possible examiner question is you're showing them, you know, the CG envelope, and they might say, if the CG is too far forward, how would that affect flight? So you might say, too far forward center of mass can cause the aircraft to pitch so far down that it makes climbing in the aircraft nearly impossible. It would also put a lot of stress on the control surfaces and decrease performance. In landing, a nose-heavy CG would make it extremely difficult, if not impossible, to flare, and could cause excessive loads on the nose wheel or a nose-over condition on a tailwheel aircraft. They might also ask, what if the CG is too far aft? How would that affect flight? And you might say too far aft center of mass can cause the aircraft to want to constantly pitch up, making it harder to control and ultimately less stable. Aircraft loaded with an aft CG are unstable at any speed and can make recovering from a stall or spin extremely difficult, if not impossible. A too far aft CG causes a decrease in both static and dynamic longitudinal stability, as well as violent stall characteristics. So be ready for questions around stability and how a too far forward or too far aft CG can affect your flight, right? They might have you do your weight and balance, and they might have you add, maybe they'll change their weight from 150 pounds to 300 pounds so that you have a lot of weight in the front of the aircraft in that passenger seat. So now you're going to have a nose, kind of think about what they're trying to do, right? They're trying to say, okay, they're trying to create a nose heavy situation. And then they might ask, how might this affect us on landing, right? So a nose heavy CG will make it really hard to flare, might cause a nose over, blah, 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 blah. So that's kind of what you want to think about when you're doing your weight and balance. Let's see if there's any other questions I can think of here. After showing them the weight and balance, they might tell you that you are bringing an additional weight with you. So like I said, right, they might change a weight on you or something, and they might ask you to recalculate and say, did the additional weight move the CG? So what you want to do here is you want to compare the CG location with your first calculation with the new one, and if it's different, then it moved. And the change they give you may shift the CG slightly if it's in a location that's far away from the empty weight's arm length, right? So the empty weight CG, if you're adding weight, you know, much further forward than that or much further aft, then it's definitely going to have more of an effect on changing the CG. And they might say something like, if the CG moved, how does this affect flight? It's kind of what we talked about. And then kind of judge that they're going for, you know, too far forward CG, how that affects flight, too far aft CG, how that affects flight, like we talked about. And then they may further add to that scenario, right? So they might say, they might give you added weight that actually puts you over the total. So that's another thing you got to watch out for. You know, are you within the max gross weight for your aircraft? And I could see an examiner, you know, giving you a weight that puts you over that max gross weight. So maybe it's by like 40 pounds or something like that. And so then you say, well, actually, you know, we're over the max gross weight. So before you even need to calculate the CG, right, you can just say that. And they might say, okay, well, how can we get under the max gross weight? You know, what are some things we can do? And you could say, well, we could maybe take out some fuel, or we can get rid of the baggage. And they might say, well, you can't take out a baggage. So like, okay, well, I'm going to take out fuel, and it's 40 pounds we need to lose, 6 pounds per gallon. So we're going to lose 7 gallons. And then they might say, what risk considerations do you have in this scenario? And then now you think of the next thing, like, what does removing fuel mean? You know, now do you have enough fuel for your planned flight, right? So you're going to have planned a check ride scenario with them. And so you'll have maybe go reference that total fuel that you calculated. And you say, well, I calculated that we're only going to need, you know, 27 gallons for our flight. You know, our aircraft holds 48 gallons of usable fuel. So if we take 7 from that, you know, I planned filling up all the way. So if we take 7 gallons from that, then we're at 41 gallons. We're still well over even, you know, getting to our destination and having all the reserve fuel. So we're good to go. We can remove 7 gallons. And then that may lead them to ask, like, well, what are those fuel requirements? And you might want to say, well, you know, during the day, we need 30 extra minutes at cruise flight and 45 minutes if it's at night. Things like that, that I could see an examiner kind of leading towards in their questions while you're doing your weight and balance. So that, I'm glad I remembered that. I think those were good for the weight and balance. So now that you've done that, the next kind of step is you're going to go over your cross-country scenario. So before you go out to the aircraft, do your pre-flight check and do all that stuff, the oral exam is still not over with. The next step is kind of the check ride scenario. So they're going to probably be like, all right, well, it looks like we're with the aircraft is airworthy. You've done a good job proving that. It looks like you're airworthy. So now show me what the flight we're going on today and walk me through our flight and our checkpoints. And then they're going to ask you questions throughout that process as well. And that's what we're going to cover in the next episode. And then after that, we're going to talk about, you know, more oral exam type questions and then get into what to expect on the practical part of the exam. And then after that, like mid-May, we'll do a mock check ride episode. All right. So stay tuned for that. Got a lot of good stuff coming up. And don't forget about the scholarship. Stay tuned for that. Don't forget to check out our mobile app on Android or Apple. Just search Part-Time Pilot. Donate to the scholarship coming up or share it. The GoFundMe link is in the show notes. And be sure to get ready for our IFR course coming out. Lots and lots of good stuff coming from us. So thank you guys, and I'll catch you next week.
Did you know that Part-Time Pilot's Ultimate Private Pilot Test Prep book just won a Pulitzer Prize? Okay, no, it didn't win a Pulitzer Prize, but it was just updated for the recent changes we saw made to the FAA written exam. So now the book has everything that our ground school has and the same questions and test bank that our ground school has that students are averaging over a 90% on the FAA written exam. It's now up on Amazon, and you can find it in our show notes on every episode. So go ahead and check that out. Hey guys, it's Nick. I want to take a second to speak directly to the student pilots out there. You might be a student pilot that is you know, wondering what to do next, how to get started, or maybe you're looking for the right ground training or flight training, or maybe you've already started ground training or flight training and you're stuck, you're in a rut, and you're looking for a change, something to help get you out of that hurdle. From my own experience in flight training, after 3 years, 5 instructors, and $22,000, and wanting to quit multiple times, and then now, after seeing hundreds and hundreds of student pilots through part-time pilot, I've realized that the number one thing that makes student pilots fail is that they do not have a good fundamental understanding of the ground training when they get to the more advanced flight lessons. Now, who here has seen Top Gun Maverick? Do you remember in the movie when he says, "Don't think, just do"? Now, when I heard this, I was like, oh my goodness, this is brilliant, because this is exactly what you have to be as a pilot. Now, of course, it's not that we're not thinking, but it's that we understand things like weather, aerodynamics, what our instruments are telling us, what ATC is telling us. We have such a good core fundamental understanding of these things that we don't have to think about them. And when we don't have to think about them, we can instinctively feel and fly the aircraft, look out for dangers, and avoid emergency situations. If we do have to think about these things, it's going to put us behind mentally, and we're going to be behind the aircraft. And when you're behind the aircraft mentally, bad things happen. And this happens when you don't have a good understanding of the ground school content. So now, the first 10 to 15 hours of your flight training can go smooth, even if you don't have a good understanding of ground training, right? You can go up for discovery flight, have a blast. You can go up, learn how to take off, learn how to land. You may be even able to solo for the first time, fly a plane for the first time. Everything's great and dandy. But once you get into, you know, bad weather flying, or flying at heavily trafficked airports, or speaking with ATC for Bravo clearance, or cross-country flight planning and flying solo on a cross-country flight, things get a little more advanced. And when this happens and you don't have a good understanding of the ground school concepts, you're gonna hit a wall. You're gonna start to get behind the aircraft. And when this happens, if you have a good flight instructor, they're going to stop you and they're going to say, okay, we need to do one-on-one ground lessons. And now you're going to be paying your flight instructor to not even fly with you, but instead $50, $60, $70 an hour to just teach you the ground school content that you should already know. And the worst part is you're not flying with them. So the flight training that you gained, the currency, the proficiency that you gained, is going to be lost, and you're going to have to redo those lessons. What happens to most student pilots is they continuously hit these mental blocks where they get behind the aircraft, they start making mistakes, and then they catch up with the ground knowledge only to have that happen again. And they start to get in this vicious cycle of having to redo trainings and repay for trainings until it gets to the point where them or their family, they finally say, you know what, this has to stop. We can no longer afford the training costs without any progress, you know, and they end up quitting. Now, so how do we avoid that? Well, here comes part-time pilot. Again, I said I went through my own experience of this, and I realized that most flight training and ground training is not tailored to the modern-day student pilot. And when I say modern-day student pilot, I should say modern-day part-time student pilot, because let's face it, there's a very small percentage of us that can go and dedicate 24/7, 365 to our flight training, or not even miss a beat and be able to pay for flight training without working. So most of us have a full-time job, or maybe a part-time job. We have kids, we have family, we have school, we have all these other responsibilities on top of flight training. And most of these flight trainings and ground trainings are not tailored towards you. And so how is it the part-time pilot tailors to the modern day student pilot? Well, the first way we do that is by keeping ground school interesting. You want to avoid being boring, you want to avoid that burnout. So how we do that is we present our material in multiple ways, and you're actually listening to one of them right now. You can consume our content via this podcast and an audio recording. You can do this while you're running, while you're driving in traffic, again, tailoring to that busy part-time student pilot. Or you can read through our written lessons. You know, I like to read, so for those of you that like to read, you can read through the lessons, you can see the step-by-step examples and the procedures that we have, or you can look through our study guide and see our diagrams and mnemonic devices, have that visual cue, those visual cues and aids that help further your understanding, or you can watch our videos. or you can take our quizzes and practice tests to reinforce what you just learned. And then finally, you can join us live weekly for our live Q&A and our live lessons, so you can see in real time these things taught out and these examples done in real time. And then finally, you can utilize our group community, form study groups, get questions answered 24/7. All of this is tailored for the modern day student pilot to keep ground school interesting, keep it from being boring, keep from having that burnout, and to find ways that you can consume the content throughout your busy schedule. And guess what? It works. We've had over 350 student pilots come through, take and pass their FAA exams without a single student failing. That's right. A single student has yet to tell me that they failed either their FAA written or their FAA check ride. So that is just proof in the pudding right there that our concepts, the way we explain things in plain written English, and the way we give you multiple ways to consume this content is working. So if this sounds like something you might be interested in and you want to come join us, we'd love to have you. Just go to www.parttimepilot.com, click on online ground school, and we'll see you inside the online ground school. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you guys next week.